Herr Präsident Markschies, Professor, Herr Professor Pernice, Herr Dr. Sabatil, meine Damen und Herren, guten Tag. There ends my German. The rest is in English, forgive me. Herr President, you asked the question, you know, what would a theologian, a mere church historian, have to offer a president who is a lawyer? We lawyers admit this is a difficult question, to which there are many obvious answers that are not going to be of much benefit to lawyers, I'm quite sure. But I know that one of the great benefits of being a theologian and a president of a university is that having a direct line to God, you are able to organize the sunshine. Which is a remarkable talent that many university presidents and vice chancellors would wish for. So congratulations on that. In choosing my title today, mentioning the expression Europe in the coming times, I'm echoing a late 19th century Irish poem by the poet Yeats. And I really did feel coming to a legendary university with 29 Nobel laureates that I would have to respond with at least one Irish Nobel laureate. And that, of course, is our great poet, William Butler Yeats, who in that poem imagined a future Ireland. It was written at a time of great flux. Frankly, any poet writing at any time in Irish history is always writing in a time of great flux. And it was characterized by competing visions of our national identity and our national destiny. So to try to conjure up the future, to try and project ourselves forward to the future, it's a kind of a fundamental human trait. We do it all the time, I suppose, in our personal lives, in our communities. And I think it is the stamp of a people, of a responsible society, to want to plan for the future, never to become too smug, too self-satisfied. But there are occasions in our history when our collective thinking about the coming times, about our future, when it's absolutely vital. And the opening decade of this century is, I believe, such a very important time. I recently came across some words by Peter Drucker on the impact of large-scale change in history. He says, every few hundred years throughout Western history, a sharp transformation has occurred. In a matter of decades, society altogether rearranges itself. Its worldviews, its basic values, its social and political structure, its arts, its key institutions. And 50 years later, a new world exists. And the people born into that world cannot even imagine the world in which their grandparents lived and into which their own parents were born. It's a pretty perfect description of where we are at today. We're living right this moment through a period of flux, just as Drucker describes. A powerful perception of rapid change. Of course, it gives rise to excitement, a great sense of excitement about the potential that is being unlocked, but also, on the other side, a degree of uncertainty, maybe even fear, apprehension, about the dizzying pace of change and about where that change could be taking us. To what extent can we shape that change? This university's founder, the great philologist and expert in the origins of language, Humboldt himself, has, believe it or not, a very special importance for Ireland. Humboldt was among the very first experts to identify the Indo-Germanic group of languages. It was he who first established that our native Irish language, our Gaelic language, belonged to that family of European languages. A simple enough finding, you might think, but with very, very profound consequences for Ireland. For building on his work, later German linguists codified the grammar and the structure of our language. But it was Humboldt's work, that foundation stone, that represented and led to a moment of very profound cultural awakening, you could say reawakening in Ireland. It inspired a renewed sense of Ireland's belonging to a common European tradition, a new pride in our language and its traditions. You could say he introduced us to our very DNA. Cultural nationalism in Ireland went hand in hand with very intense political debate about our relationship with Britain and the nature of Ireland's identity. Of course, Ireland's sense of belonging in Europe has very deep roots in our history. It's illustrated in the lives of those like the 7th century Irish monk, whom you mentioned, St. Killing of Würzburg, and we're over the fact that you killed him. We're over that. Because, of course, you've made up for it so many times over by making him archbishop, by making him patron, and, of course, naming so many children Killian. So we're long over that, you'll be glad to hear. But he helped to secure Europe's Christian values and, again, created this formidable historic link between Ireland and Germany. Humboldt's discovery, assisted indeed by a team of subsequent philologists, that discovery that our national language, long derided, it has to be said, and long humiliated, was a full member of the family of European languages, underlined the European pedigree of our culture. And since that time, Ireland has consistently demonstrated, time and time again, that Europe is indeed a very big part of our DNA. It is inseparable from our national destiny. The European Union has travelled an immense distance since the founding generation developed that bold, that remarkable, miraculous vision of Europe in their coming times, back in the second part, the dreadful aftermath of the first part of the 20th century. The appalling upheavals of that century taught us so harshly, at such appalling cost, the importance of enlightened political leadership rooted in democratic values, in pluralist values. Europe's traumas that were caused by the twisted vision of evil men, they brought out on the other side the vision of great men, men like Adenauer, whose goal was nothing less than, in his words, a great common house for Europeans, a house of freedom. Nothing represented the realization of Adenauer's dream like the coming down of the Berlin Wall, which had so disfigured this city and so shamed our continent. Today, a revitalized Berlin gives living proof that no barrier is insurmountable and that no dividing line is ever permanent so long as the human spirit yearns for its righteous freedom. Goals that would have seemed utterly utopian in the 1950s, in a Europe still finding its post-war feet, have now been realized. Europe is peaceful, it is united, it is prosperous. And we benefit daily from a single market, from the existence of the euro. 27 countries, so many once estranged, now work together in pursuit of shared ambitions that are founded on the very, very best of human values. So from the ashes of war, from the ashes of chaos, arose a structure that is built to last for centuries. But for that structure to last, it has, of course, to accommodate change. And so the question has to be asked, what next? Where does that change take us to? If Europe is to retain its role as a centre of gravity, a centre of sanity in our world, I think we can take great satisfaction in looking back at how far we've come in a relatively short period of time. But still, our eyes have got to be firmly focused on the future, on a coherent future, a stable future, underpinned by humanly decent values. And these things we are called to build, to nurture, to grow, to sustain, to develop one day at a time, because that is how we build our future in our lived lives, day in, day out. For more than 20 years now, the union has been predictably preoccupied with its internal affairs. And the preoccupation has paid off richly, a rich harvest. It has served Europe well. Ireland has been a particular beneficiary, as you've heard. The poor country that joined the European Union 35 years ago is now, I think, a showcase of what Europe is capable of delivering. Our economic fortunes have been transformed in less than a generation. We who were poor, we whose greatest export was our people, we are now a wealthy country which now welcomes migrants to our shores, the first time in 150 years that our population has grown. And there is now a growing consensus that the Union needs to begin to look outward more, way beyond our borders, because that world around us is also changing at an unrelenting pace. And many of the challenges that are faced by national governments completely defy boundaries in terms of their resolution. An issue like climate change is possibly the best example, because we know that it simply is no respecter of borders or boundaries, and the only effective solution is in a solution that comes from people working together right around the world. In the Irish language, we have an expression that says, Níart go Curlic Héile, and that translates as, strength comes only when we act together. I think it even means a little bit more than that. I think it means that we don't even begin to understand our fullest potential humanly until we work with others. Our belief in collective action as the source of strength and the real core of the common good is woven into every aspect of Irish life, and indeed into our custom and practice. The word mehel, for example, is a word that we use to describe collective action to meet a challenge, most commonly used to describe the bringing in of the harvest, when one farmer on his own could not bring in the harvest, but everybody working together could do it in the right time frame, have the harvest stored in good time. And in storing the harvest, storing also friendship, commonality, community, these things that build us up humanly. And that is today how our communities, whether they are urban or rural, are organised around neighbour helping neighbour. Because without that commonality, without that hand-to-hand, that bridge that is the handshake, we are simply strangers to one another. And no one wants to live in a world where we are simply strangers to one another. So it is our shared focus, our shared responsibility that builds care in our hearts for one another, that builds community. And it's these ingrained values in Irish life that helped us to survive the hard times going back 150 years ago when famine claimed 1 million of our people and sent 2 million on the emigrant ships, turning us forever, it seemed, into an emigrant nation, forever altering the trajectory of Irish history. And from that grim experience, which is very deeply rooted in the Irish psyche, we know very well the potential for environmental failure to become a dreadful, appalling, almost irreversible social and humanitarian disaster. And we know what happens, because we were the victims of it, when the powerful stick rigidly to their mindset and their beliefs, refusing to change and selfishly delaying action until it is way too late. And so with this experience behind us, Ireland's international relations are guided by the ideal of peace and friendly cooperation among nations, the peaceful settlement of international disputes, and the principles of international law as its rules of conduct in its relationships with other states. These principles guide our approach to relationships with the wider world. We follow a policy of military neutrality and non-involvement in military alliances. It's a position not always completely understood. But let me explain very simply that our neutrality is not to be equated with indifference. We care very deeply about our world, and we care very deeply about conflict resolution in our world. And our history and our geography have shaped us, fashioned us, if you like, in a particular approach to international affairs. We well understand that our European neighbours have also been shaped by history differently, and they make different choices. We respect those choices. But Ireland, for example, has been an active member of the United Nations since 1995. Membership of the United Nations has allowed us, given us a platform in which to develop our own distinctive role in the world, focusing on issues such as development aid, disarmament, and human rights. From the very beginning, we felt strongly the obligations imposed by membership, and so for the last 50 years, Irish Defence Forces have had a continuous presence on United Nations peacekeeping missions. Today, Irish servicemen and women serve in UN-mandated missions in Kosovo, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Lebanon. The recent UN mission to Chad is in fact under the control of an Irish Brigadier General. And so this service, as all such service, has not been without costs. Indeed, many members of our Defence Forces have given their lives proudly in the service of the United Nations, and we indeed are also very proud of those who have served and served us so well. The nature of peace support operations has also changed in recent decades, and it's quite right that the European Union, arguably the most successful peace process in history, should develop its own capacity to build peace elsewhere in the world. The Union's purpose is to consolidate, to support democracy, the rule of law, to promote human rights. And its efforts to preserve peace, to prevent conflicts, to strengthen international security are all done completely in accordance with the United Nations Charter. A very important, and thank you, a very, very important issue for Ireland and for Europe. Our Irish Police Service, for example, has also played its part. I look forward to their participation very soon in the European Union Rule of Law mission that is planned now for Kosovo, where the European Union will play such a vital role in ensuring the consolidation of peace and stability there. As we see it, our interests are best advanced through the pursuit of principled policies backed up by Europe's economic resources. Our vision of Europe is that it has to strive to be a new type of power in the world, one that is founded on the pursuit of values as much as on the defence of interests. As a small country with really a very baleful experience of colonisation, Ireland has traditionally had, predictably, well-grounded, grave reservations about great power politics. We see patient diplomacy, persistent, respectful dialogue, and dogged persuasion as the best instruments for creating a better world. We value the contribution of international organisations, and we are absolutely unstinting in our support for the United Nations. We see peace, development, and human rights as inextricably linked, and we aim to be a world leader in development assistance. We are resolute in our determination to reach the United Nations target of 0.7% of GNP by 2012. We're pretty well on target. This commitment enjoys considerable public support in Ireland, and the value of solidarity with the world's poor is strongly recognised by our people. It's a byproduct of our own experience. It is not so long ago that we were counted among the world's poor, among the world's most overlooked of peoples. Our government, through our Irish aid programme, our development aid programme, is giving practical expression to the defining values of modern Ireland. It's following in the footsteps of thousands of Irish men and women, lay and missionary, priests and nuns, ministers of all denominations, soldiers, policemen, NGOs, aid workers of all sorts, who for many years have offered themselves and their skills to the poorest of the poor in the most troubled of countries, and who are by far, far our very best ambassadors, saving the presence, of course, of our best ambassador here, David Donoghue. The island of Ireland has known generations, actually centuries, if the truth be told, of conflict. But today, our best educated generation ever, our most high-achieving generation ever, has used its brain power and its collective distilled historic memory to shift us coherently from conflict to consensus. We hope that the journey we have made from violence to peace will serve as an encouragement to other nations which are still so bogged down in seemingly intractable conflict. And we are now taking solid steps to transfer the knowledge that we have gleaned through our own various peace processes and now our successful peace processes. Frankly, I think that most of our wisdom comes from our mistakes, comes from the bad things, if you like, the mistakes that we made, rather than in some ways our successes. But we take this distilled wisdom of our success now and we offer it to other states. For example, we have just appointed our first roving ambassador to Timor-Leste, a woman with extraordinary experience of consensus building in the Northern peace process. In the years ahead, the Union has the potential to play an even greater role in promoting our shared European values and protecting our shared European interests right around the world. A case in point is that case of global warming, which has just such potential to damage not just our future interests, but actually those of all humanity on an unparalleled scale. I know it's an issue that the Germans are much preoccupied by and indeed have been given tremendous leadership on. And the global community has at last begun to rally, begun to listen to the warning voices, and so now to rally to spare future generations from the consequences of cataclysmic climate change. The agreement reached in Bali reassures us that an international consensus is at last beginning to mount, does have momentum. But Europe has to remember its destiny as an international leader. This is a time that calls for very, very determined leadership. As advanced economies, we occupy such privileged positions. And though there are undoubtedly going to be real costs, there are going to be sacrifices ahead. In truth, we know the people who will suffer first, the people who will suffer worst, are those who are already most vulnerable, most poor. They will bear the brunt. And we are called to be their shield as well as our own. In Copenhagen in 2009, I hope that the champions of coherent collective international action will be vindicated, among them, of course, no better champion than your own Chancellor and indeed the federal government, who within the European Union and the G8 have articulated a vision on the climate change agenda that is absolutely inspiring, praiseworthy indeed. Germany itself has made real progress, been a great witness to what is achievable in renewable energy technologies. We in Ireland are committed to a 33% target for electricity from renewable sources by 2020. It's a very ambitious target for us, but it's one that we set because we firmly believe that it's only by investing in large-scale renewable energy programs that we can create the incentives for research and industry that will make renewable energy cost-effective, efficient, as well as sustainable. Europe is engaged in a great economic endeavour to equip our 27 economies for everything that they are to face in this extraordinary globalized world that we are facing into. Here in Germany, you are the largest exporter in the world, the traditional industrial heartland of Europe, and so you understand these issues better than most. In the late 19th century, when Yeats wrote the poem To Ireland in the Coming Times, the future tended to be seen in terms of either national or imperial issues. In Ireland, we resisted the then fashionable imperial vision of the world with its very narrow protected elites and its overlooked masses. We insisted as a people on a vision of the innate human dignity of every single human being, on his or her right to flourish, to reach their full potential in freedom, to their equality of opportunity. And that vision was only secured for Irish men and women by insisting on our right to our own independence, by insisting on an independent future for ourselves, and then exercising that independence. With our newfound sovereignty, we chose to join the European Union, the only union, incidentally, we have ever volunteered to join. We've been volunteered by other people, but this is the first that we joined ourselves, which is why we are so committed to it. So in some ways, the European Union is our lodestar as we seek to plot a course through a very, very changing world, so rapidly changing it is at times dizzying. And we hope to see the Union develop its full potential as a prosperous knowledge economy, as a very peaceful common homeland to all its children, as a champion of good values and good practice, both at home internally and right around the world, as a witness, a powerful witness to the power of mehel, the power of partnership in diversity, and to the benefits that come from putting conflict behind us and building consensus. A friend, I hope, to the world's poor, to the most neglected, to the most overlooked. They surely need friends. In this, the European Year of Intercultural Dialogue, many of our countries, including Ireland, grow more multicultural, multi-faith, multilingual by the day. And if we mean what we say about Europe's founding value system, with its reverence, its respect, its sense of sacredness about the dignity of each human being, then our task is to build in our individual countries and through our union a deep, deep-rooted culture of acceptance of difference, of really joyful curiosity about one another, and of profound respect, so that strangers live easily in harmony as neighbours and easily become colleagues, friends, neighbours. Already in the movements of peoples throughout Europe, whether they're following the stars of economic prosperity or tourism, academic exchange, we are living the emergence of the great European dream dreamt by Schuman, dreamt by Adenauer, a Europe of good neighbours, a Europe of mehel, pulling together for a shared future and not pulling Europe apart for selfish ends. And so now our generation faces a very different context and very different challenges. But we have the gift of a stable union, a growing union, full of optimism and enthusiasm. And that is the resource. That is the resource we bring to the world. It is, in fact, our bridge to the coming times, a carefully constructed, powerful bridge to the coming times. So, what will we do when we cross that bridge? Will we make poverty history? Will we see an end to the misery of the Middle East? Will we see East and West grow in mutual harmony and understanding? Will the great faiths of the world become sources of unity rather than discord? Will we stabilize our global climate? Will we give our children a legacy of optimism and hope such as no other generation in history has ever known. Those are the challenges we face, every single one of them achievable. Every single one of them achievable. Nothing intractable, everything doable, provided we pull together. Common focus, sharing, each one of us, the unique gifts and talents and perspectives we have, and using them as our gift to make this bridge to the future the strongest that we can. Speaking back in 1994, at a time when everybody would have characterised Ireland as one of the intractable conflicts in the world, as we began to emerge from the nightmare of violence, another Irish Nobel laureate, John Hume, described what has been achieved by the European project. He said, "They build common institutions which preserve their differences, which allow them to work the common ground, giving bread on our tables, a roof over our heads, the right to existence, not just the right to life, but the right to a decent standard of living, to a home, a job, an education, to health." They, that is the European Union, broke down the prejudices of centuries to make the healing process take place. We should be so proud of what our European Union has accomplished. I'm sure in the company of a theologian, I'm allowed to use the word miracle. Nothing short of miracle. This continent is littered with the graves of young men who, if they were asked this day, "What did we do? What did you do with the world that we left behind, that we did not know the joy of growing up in, marrying in, having children in?" They would tell us what we have created is nothing short of miracle. I think they would be very proud of this Europe. It is an extraordinary achievement. It is our inheritance. It is no mausoleum. It is no place of mere words. It is a place of extraordinary achievement. And importantly, it is a leaven in our lives. It is a growing phenomenon. It is a leaven in our lives, on our continent, and in our world. It is still, thankfully, very, very young. It is still growing. It is still dreaming big dreams. There is still much, much work to be done. And we who are in this room, we who are members, we who are citizens of the 27 member states, we are the hands of the work. We are the brains, but we are the hands of the work. Translating work, words into work, words into action. And so we are also the sacred custodians of the miracle that is modern Europe, that is already Europe of the coming times. Danke sehr.